Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. My name is Stephanie Murray. I'm the author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook, and I'm here with my wonderful co-host Jennifer Smith and Mass Inc. Polling Group President Steve Cazella. So we're here for another edition of the Horse Race Happy Hour live stream. We're doing it live, so if you're listening to this later, we are broadcasting live on Facebook. And so I have to ask you guys, what are you drinking this afternoon?
That's a key question for a happy hour podcast, which this is. I like this, that we've moved it from like noon in our little tiny room where it would be like sweltering hot and we'd just, you know, be drinking out of a water bottle. Now it's 4:30. We're all sitting at home. I've got a margarita. Jen, what do you have?
I've got this adorable little coupe glass with the bee's knees. So it's like a honey lemon gin drink. Ooh, and I love it. It's great.
That was what I was going to make, but I didn't feel like squeezing lemons, so I didn't.
You guys are a little fancier than me. I just have a harpoon.
Yeah.
Open.
This podcast is not being sponsored by Harpoon, but after that product placement, it probably should be. Anyway, so right here at the top is typically where we waste everyone's time talking about Listen to Your Heart, that Bachelor spinoff that for some reason we've decided it's our duty on this podcast to talk about. And this week is no exception because this week was the finale. It's over. It's done. Brie and Chris won. Mm-hmm. Brie and Chris won. I do have to say, though, the show did leave with a lot of questions, including, I think the question that still remained at the end was, what were the actual rules? Like, how did the show actually work?
Stephanie?
I found it to be a very underwhelming ending. I don't know why they threw in fantasy suites with like 45 minutes left in the episode. And I just, you know, I think my big takeaway from Listen to Your Heart was how shocking and incredible it was that they got so many candidates or contestants to nuke themselves off the show. Like every episode, somebody or a couple was like, we've made the decision to leave.
We're done. It's not like, hey, we're still going to compete and just sort of fake it. It's like, we're going to take ourselves out. Not being an expert in Bachelor lore, is this something that like the producers just like, you wait till you're out of the room and then they're like, listen, you're out. You can do it however you want, but you're gone. Like, make it happen. Or do we think that this was something that the participants just came up with on their own?
Well, this is the thing that really got me. And it's a good point, Steve and Stephanie, that like the rules were really confusing because every once in a while, Chris Harrison would just wander into the room, say, I want you to think really hard about your relationships. And then they apparently did, go and have a very complicated chat with someone, which again, I would like to point out, there are no stakes here, folks. This is like a 4 to 6 week, like this is a very, very short thing here. And so he would come in, say, think very carefully. They would go have discussions. And every once in a while, like this week where Matt just told Rudy, basically he wasn't where he thought he would be in their relationship and then took himself out of the race, which then stopped her from even having a shot at winning.
Was. Right. Do we know what the prize was? They like got on a tour bus and then...
I think it's just like a recording contract to do some covers of love songs. I think that's what it is. And also a paid for not honeymoon.
Well, you know, yeah. I'm glad that we spent so many weeks and so many hours of our lives talking about it. This is 3 bad Bachelor endings in a row. We had Hannah Brown, who got swindled by Jed. And then we had Peter, everybody knows what happened there. And now this ending that didn't really make that much sense either. So Chris Harrison.
Yep.
Chris Harrison, do better.
What's going on? We're losing viewers by the ones here, Jen. So steer us out of this.
Yeah,
segment.
I was going to say, why don't we turn from this cacophonous insult to the concept of dating to something that everyone cares much more about, which is actual horse racing news. Right. Because
That's not what this podcast is about, though.
It is right now. It is for the next 15 seconds because the Belmont Stakes has been rescheduled and shortened for June 20th. And that's actually going to now be the first leg of the Triple Crown, which obviously normally would be the Kentucky Derby, which is now moved to September. And I really enjoyed this little kerfuffle over the slight shortening of the Belmont Stakes, which is pretty long. And the rationale given for it initially was like, look, these horses haven't raced professionally for many, many months. They're coming back. There's no audience. Like, we're not going to make them go the full length. Let's be reasonable people here. So the Belmont Stakes is shorter, but it is starting it. And this kind of random chaos reflects some general confusion here in the home front, doesn't it, Steve?
That's right. I mean, the Triple Crown is changing the rules. And here in Massachusetts, sorry, somebody on Twitter asked us to make this tie-in, so I'm just going to do it now. the Triple Crown changed the rules, just like we here in Massachusetts are looking at instituting voting by mail and changing the rules for how we conduct elections here in Massachusetts. So there's your tie-in, Mara Dolan. Please send the check to Horse Race Global Media Empire headquarters. Anyway, in all seriousness, there are big changes afoot to how we here in Massachusetts cast our ballots. There's been discussion for the last few weeks, as we've talked about on this podcast, about how to do it, because, of course, you can have pretty strong agreement on the idea that, you know, vote by mail is a good thing. And the more people that don't show up at the polling place but can still cast their ballots, the better, but still not agree on things like, do we send everybody an application or do we send everybody a ballot? You know, does it have to be postmarked by the right date or does it have to be received by the right date? Do we send unenrolled voters every primary ballot or do we make them request one? And all these little details make big differences. So there are a lot of changes afoot, but that is something that we're all keeping an eye on and has really no particular relationship to the Triple Crown, but we did the tie-in anyway. So let's pat ourselves in the back.
Yeah. And if anyone, of course, wants to hear us talk in more detail about actually the discussion going on in Massachusetts a few weeks ago when we were kind of just hitting our stride on this Zoom version of the horse race, we talked to State Senator Becca Rausch about a few of the vote by mail options. So if you want to listen to us talk about that in more detail, head on into the past because time has no purpose, no meaning. It's a flat circle. Go listen to us talk about that.
She was quite interesting on that, though, so I would recommend that episode for sure.
Absolutely. And, you know, unlike the Triple Crown and vote by mail and all of these other things, we know more about the state's reopening phases now. So we have four reopening phases, and Governor Charlie Baker kind of announced on Monday what they would sort of look like. I think there are still a lot of question marks about what is going to happen over the next few weeks. But he moved the state to a safer at home advisory instead of a stay at home advisory. And so some things are opening, churches with some precautions, beaches will open on the 25th, and then restaurants sometime in phase two. What are you guys thinking about this reopening situation?
Well, I tend to always be that person who's like, let's talk about the disagreements between the state and the city, but also kind of just disagreements between elected officials in Massachusetts about what the best approach to any given policy is. So, as usual, there's some disagreement between the state order and the city's plans. Mayor Marty Walsh said the governor was trying for a thoughtful approach, but said, you know, a 25% capacity reopen within a month is not necessarily in the best interest of Boston. So pushing back a bit there. I know Baker responded to that this afternoon, saying, you know, that's the maximum and we feel we can do it safely with additional precautions. Interestingly, and this is the thing I'd love to get some of your takes on, everyone was being pretty careful with their critiques here, even if they did disagree with some fundamentals of the opening plan, aside from Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. So Walsh, Maura Healey, and some others said the approach was measured, but then raised specific concerns about the plan, like around the childcare system, for instance, and saying there needed to be consistent guidelines and more immediate financial support for childcare programs, whereas Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley just flat out said this is too rushed and has the potential to be very harmful to residents of color and low-income communities. So what have you two been thinking about kind of either the reopening plan itself or the response to it?
I think there's sort of a bunch of angles you could look at from the things you just outlined. I mean, childcare is one, which I think is just the massive one that we do not have figured out yet. And there's a few reasons for that, I think, that are worth noting. One is that the pace at which reopening went from we're going to announce it to, hey, now things are allowed to be reopened was way too fast for anybody who was affected by that order to be able to actually create any sort of sensible childcare plan. Another thing to look at is that the businesses that are being allowed to reopen, there's not perfect rhyme or reason to it, really. Like, there's things which basically involve similar kinds of like physical arrangements, I guess, for lack of a better term, of where people are and where their customers are that are allowed, and things that are basically the same that aren't allowed. So, you know, I think there is a lot of criticism. But I guess the real question is the fact that there's criticism from both sides, both the retailers, you know, who are typically more conservative, the Mass Retailers Association, and Ayanna Pressley, who obviously is much further to the left. Does that mean there's something right about the plan, or does it mean that there's things wrong on, you know, in every direction with the plan?
I think the biggest problem here is that nobody really knows what to do because this has never really happened before. And even looking at different plans state by state, the order is all different depending on the state. In New Jersey, they're doing outdoor dining first instead of waiting to do restaurants like we're doing. And then they're putting hair salons all the way into their phase three when we're opening hair salons in phase one. So it doesn't seem like hair salons are any different in New Jersey than they are in Massachusetts. And so I think it's just one of those, like, you can't really tell who is right or wrong or what. It seems like every state is just trying to figure it out on their own. And I think that speaks to kind of the broader issue that there's been sort of a lack of guidance from the federal government. And so governors and mayors and people like that, and even local town administrators have really had to step in and fill that gap.
Yeah. And I mean, the hair salons is such an interesting example right now where anecdotally, like the salon that usually does my hair canceled everything, obviously, once the pandemic started and all the shutdown orders went in place. But now, I mean, obviously, because there's a business incentive where if they're allowed to reopen, they're very much going to be harmed if they don't. You know, they've already started reaching out just to kind of gauge people's availability over the summer. And I, of course, was like, no, I will look like a shaggy human being. I will not be going anywhere.
And I will virtue signal with it.
I will have slightly longer hair.
I was complaining about my roots before we went live.
Yeah, exactly. But so, I mean, you know, kind of to that point, though, I am kind of curious as well about one of the concerns that Maura Healey raised as well, which was the any kind of violations or any sort of dangerous conditions, like the onus to report them kind of seems to be on the workers, unless there's a specific spot check. So I mean, that is kind of an uncomfortable element too, which is like the businesses want to reopen, workers have to go in some cases or be fired, but then are they also supposed to police their own workplaces for safety concerns? So there have been kind of a lot of questions about this. I think, again, it was kind of a middle of the road plan, as Steve pointed out, but we'll keep an eye on that, I think. But we're not at a hair salon right now. We're in our respective homes. Why?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of what you just kind of mentioned, Jen, though, just before we move on to talking about other things, is that moving from where we have been, which is a very simple set of guidelines, very straightforward. Like, if you can stay home, you're staying home. You know, don't go near anybody. Don't do anything. Like, it's just very straightforward, basically the minimum possible. And now we're opening up little doors, but every single one you go through has 26 different rules. And it kind of puts, as you said, Jen, it puts the onus on the individual and therefore requires the individual and groups to kind of come up with their own social rules, like on the fly. Yeah. Like, what do I say? How do I walk? What face do I make? Like, how do I position myself to indicate that, like, you're standing too close to me? You know, there's just a bunch of little things that I think we're about to have to invent a whole new set of rules after just in the last couple months, we'd kind of gotten used to, okay, there's people coming towards me on the sidewalk. Which one has kids? Which one's the bigger group? Who has the dog? Okay, the other one goes across the street. You know, we just sort of did all that. And now we're going to have to do it all again. So anyway, a new phase.
Yeah, that's right. So we are today not talking about coronavirus for the next few segments, which is, I'll Amazing. Be honest, kind of a welcome change right now. Yeah, it's
Libby's
true.
Reminding us we forgot the most important question of that, which is that apparently some businesses are going to do temperature checks, and one particular company, Simmons Industries, to reduce the stress of that temperature check is going to be playing 80s music while it takes employee temperatures to It says here in the script to make it less weird.
I don't know
if I can buy into that particular description, but the question is, what 80s song would everyone like their temperature taken to? So the floor is
open. First.
Yeah, Steve, you go first.
Oh boy, I don't even know.
He doesn't get to drop this bomb.
I'll explain where this came from while you think. So this one of the people who's in charge at Simmons Industries did a press conference with Governor Baker today, and he was talking about the mandatory temperature checks and how awkward it was when they started doing it. So to try to kind of loosen everybody up to get their temperature taken. They're playing 80s music in the hallway. That's all the time you've got, Steve. What song would you choose?
Yeah, I was thinking maybe, I don't know about 80s songs, but I was trying to think, okay, what about temperature? Like Saturday Night Fever, or like It's Getting Hot in Here, or something like that. You know, just something related to like you, something related to feeling hot. I don't know. How about you?
I was going to say, like, any opportunity I get to like blast some Whitney, I will absolutely do it. So I would happily like stand there and allow my temperature to be checked while I want to dance with somebody is there. But it might mean that I'm like bobbing my head a little too much for them to get a good read.
Yeah, that'd be awkward.
So it would be
your body temperature from dancing and you have to work.
All right, Stephanie, your turn.
I would obviously choose Pour Some Sugar on Me by Def Leppard because that is the best 80s song. I'm like checking on Facebook Live to see if anybody has the good one that we should add in. Let's see. Jonathan Richard said Higher Love by Steve Winwood.
Ryan Naismith says One Night in Bangkok. Ryan Naismith says One Night in Bangkok, which is a piece from the musical Chess, which I think is what he's referring to there. Anyway, we've spent so much time on that, plus our discussion of Listen to Your Heart, that I think it's now time to move on to our conversations of substance, which today relate to the Veep Stakes, which has taken a Massachusetts-oriented turn. We're going to be talking a little bit about what it would mean if Elizabeth Warren were chosen for vice president and all the dominoes that would fall here in Massachusetts. And then after that, we're going to be talking about a couple state Senate elections and what that could potentially signal for the future of the Mass GOP. So what do you say? Should we go forward?
Yeah, let's go, because summer is coming and I am mad about it because warm weather is not for me. And also this summer is going to be weird because crowds of people, also generally not my thing, but especially not during pandemic season. So while we can't expect to relive the crowded barbecues and beach trips of old, there is one thing we can count on for a semblance of normalcy in this crazy world and election cycle in which time has no meaning, and that is the announcement of a vice presidential pick at some point, because no clear front runner has emerged out of the several potential selections circulating through the media right now. But it's possible we could see a Bay State running mate this year. Stephanie Murray, you have been keeping a close eye on the Veep Stakes. Thoughts?
First, I have been keeping a close eye on our Twitter mentions, and Steph Solise from Mass Live says that she would get her temperature taken to I Want to Break Free by Queen.
Oh, good. Good call.
Good one, right?
Anyways, absolutely. Queen for Veep.
What we know about the Veep Stakes basically is that Joe Biden is going to choose a woman. He said it over and over again. He will choose a woman as his running mate, and he would like to nominate a Black woman to the Supreme Court. So, you know, for the first time, all of our people that we're speculating about in the Veep Stakes are women. And the one that I'm keeping my eye on as somebody who covers Massachusetts is Elizabeth Warren. A couple of others that come to mind: California Senator Kamala Harris, Stacey Abrams from Georgia, Gretchen Whitmer from Michigan. Who else am I forgetting? Oh, Nevada Senator Catherine Cortez Masto. Do you guys have any others that you're thinking about?
Val Demings from Florida was another one that was being floated. Did you mention Klobuchar already? I think you did.
Nope, forgot about Klobuchar.
Got Klobuchar, for yeah, sure. That as well. So it's like every woman who was kind of in this race to begin with. Kirsten Gillibrand was, again, one of those that was kicked around as well. So most of the female candidates for president are now being cycled as potential female vice presidents. So how you want to feel about that is up to you. But those are some of the names that we've been kicking around. I do have a question, though, for kind of both of you. I'd love your take on this. Is normally the vice presidential pick happens a little bit later in the fall as we get closer to the election itself. Is there any advantage kind of in this weird circumstance now to picking early versus later? Like, is the continued speculation a helpful news cycle, or is it kind of just killing time?
Yeah, I looked it up just to see kind of when recent past vice presidential announcements have happened. So Obama announced Biden in August. So did Mitt Romney announce Paul Ryan. Also in August, Donald Trump announced Mike Pence in July. And that's the same time when Hillary Clinton announced Tim Kaine. So we still do have a couple months left before it would even be conventional to announce a running mate. I mean, to me, the things, it doesn't feel like there's any particular rush. I mean, there's good and bad, I suppose, but the bad is that then you'd paint a target on whoever it is, and it, you know, that everybody goes into overdrive, you know, trashing whoever it is. You know, the upside would be that that it's not just Joe Biden out there anymore. And obviously there's a lot of discomfort with him among certain segments that vote. There's been this very interesting thing, for instance, that's happened in the polling where older voters now, after going for Donald Trump by, I think it was 10 points in 2016, are now voting for Joe Biden. But younger voters, several of which are watching and commenting on our Facebook feed right now, are not sold on Joe Biden, and you know, could potentially cause a problem for a Democrat for him. And maybe if there were the right vice presidential nominee and they could help kind of shore up that demographic, perhaps that could be a reason to do it early. Stephanie, what do you think?
I think that point about, you know, not just being Joe Biden anymore might be helpful to him, because instead of being able to go around and campaign and do all of this stuff in person, he really has to flood social media and flood television with him. And I think that, you know, compared to where things were in February and March with the presidential primary, the presidential election has kind of moved sort of to the back burner as we just focus on the coronavirus response. President Donald Trump, for a time, was on TV almost every day of the week for like 2 hours at a time. And so perhaps choosing somebody who might kind of lend better to being on live streams and things like that might be helpful to Biden. But, you know, if he's polling well, his name recognition is obviously, you know, he's the presumptive nominee. So I think it's like kind of one of those things where they're balancing both.
Yeah, but there's reasons for either one.
Yeah.
Here in Massachusetts, of course, it raises two big considerations. One is it raises two big considerations. One is what we just talked about. What Elizabeth Warren specifically bring to the ticket? And the other, of course, is what happens to her. To what are all the dominoes that that are going to fall? So, I guess we didn't really address the first one specific to Warren. So maybe start with that one. What in your travels, Stephanie? You've done a lot of reporting and talking to Warren and Biden supporters and elected and otherwise. What's your take on that? What does Elizabeth Warren bring to a Biden-Warren ticket?
So what Elizabeth Warren would bring, I think, is she would be able to kind of marry the progressive and more moderate sides of the party. Biden, you know, the big split was between him and Bernie Sanders. And Elizabeth Warren kind of has those similar progressive, you know, Medicare for all sort of type folks behind her. So that might be a reason to choose her. But on the other hand, there still is some leftover frustration because the race between Warren and Sanders got so personal and so tense in the primary. I think that might be a big risk. But the other thing that she brings is a really big and aggressive small dollar fundraising operation. You know, she's just got tons and tons of small donors. She's able to raise a ton of money. That's somewhere where Biden doesn't do as well.
Jen, what's your take on that one? Have we lost Jen?
I think we might have lost Jen.
I was going to say, she looked like she was thinking really hard, but I think her screen is just frozen.
She's back. There we go. Back. I froze. Okay. I froze.
Jen, what's your take on that question, which was, what does Elizabeth Warren...
Zoom just let me know very insultingly that my internet connection is unstable, and I'd like to say I have a very stable internet. So my take on Elizabeth Warren is kind of, you know, we've talked about this before, where when it comes to vice presidents, it says a lot more about the kind of candidate themselves and how they see their potential weaknesses and where they might need to kind of bulk up. So if you're looking at it kind of from a, I need to rebolster some progressive cred, as Stephanie mentioned, obviously, then Elizabeth Warren is a good option for that. One thing that also proponents of hers have been saying that I found kind of interesting as well is her history in kind of pushing for specific appointments, where the idea is maybe the vice president themselves doesn't have a lot of independent power, but they're also very, very close to the president's ear. So if you trust Elizabeth Warren, for instance, in picking people to lead certain cabinets or cabinet positions or departments, then that might be a case to have her in there. And then you can kind of do that same math looking at other potential Veep picks, saying like maybe Elizabeth Warren, if she came on, would be kind of more on the policy side of it. But maybe if there was a candidate who, for instance, was younger and kind of on a newly upward trajectory in their sort of political career, you might view picking someone like Stacey Abrams, for instance, as kind of putting her in the public eye to kind of prime them for a future presidential or national run. So, and then of course, if you're looking at Val Demings, maybe Florida is in play and maybe you want someone who's kind of on the local side there. So all of these candidates, I think, have the potential to be really interesting barometers of where the Biden campaign thinks that it needs to compromise to different elements of the party, if that's the progressive side itself, or if it does kind of want to take a play or take a crack at more vulnerable regions or particular swing states. Again, I like to think of the vice presidency as sort of the closest you get to Joe Biden literally saying, this is what I'm worried about, and this is what I'd like to reinforce.
Yeah, and if I could just add one more thing there, who Biden chooses as a vice president is going to be particularly important, and maybe more important than in cycles past, because earlier in the cycle, he was telling people that he would not run for re-election if he's elected. And so whoever his vice president is will probably be kind of the heir apparent or the person who's in the best position to run if that ends up being true and he is elected and then doesn't run.
Exactly.
So there's a million other things to say about this, but because we're talking about heirs apparent, we have to talk about the local angle, which is something that we've heard a lot about, I think, relatively and often in many cases uninformed commentary from the national political observers about her Senate seat.
Shots fired.
Well, every candidate has their pluses and minuses, but the one that gets mentioned very often about Elizabeth Warren is that it would give Charlie Baker the under current law, the power to appoint her replacement. So Stephanie, you've been all over this issue talking to members of the legislature. Is there any way that Elizabeth Warren would be allowed to be replaced by a Republican, particularly if the Senate were in close balance?
So right now, what the rules say is that that is exactly what could happen. Charlie Baker has the power to appoint whoever he wants for a short amount of time, and then there would be a special Senate election. So there are basically two options. Either the legislature leaves it alone and they let it happen, or they change the rules. And they usually change the rules. In 2004, they took the appointment power away from Mitt Romney when it seemed like John Kerry might be elected president. So Mitt Romney, Republican, couldn't appoint a Republican. It didn't end up happening. And then they changed the rules again in 2010 when the late Senator Ted Kennedy was ill and he was passing away. And that happened because it was kind of at the same time where they needed votes to pass Obamacare in the Senate. So they gave the appointment power back to Governor Deval Patrick, and then he was able to appoint somebody to go in and vote. So we're right now, lawmakers that I talked to said that they were kind of feeling dicey about voting for another rules change. There isn't one out there right now. There's one state rep who's looking at drafting legislation that would make it so the governor has to appoint somebody from the same party. So Baker would have to appoint a Democrat. But after 2010, people seem to feel kind of dicey about it. Scott Brown used them changing the rules as kind of one of the lines of his campaign. He ended up winning the special election. So they feel kind of weird about it. But a few lawmakers told me that if Joe Biden or somebody from the Biden campaign came calling, they would be more likely to look at it.
Yeah, and I think there's just a couple other things worth mentioning about this. One is that a lot depends, I think, on where the Senate is, particularly, you know, the amount of pain that it's worth. It changes a lot if, you know, whoever ends up in that seat would tilt the balance one way or the other. You know, if it's 50-49 in either direction, for instance, you know, the polling right now leaves open a lot of different possible scenarios. You could actually have a pretty considerable Democratic majority. You could be somewhere close to balanced, you know, and there's months to go yet. So it's much too early to make that kind of prediction. But that would be one thing. And then the other one, of course, is what Charlie Baker wants to do and what he actually wants. Because, you know, he, you know, much to, I think, the Mass GOP's chagrin, is still a Republican, you know, and kind of... But would he want to appoint a Republican, particularly given the blowback that it would cause if this were close? You know, if Massachusetts Democrats who have been behind him even more than Republicans have were suddenly woke up and he had tilted the balance back to Mitch McConnell where it was within reach, I think you'd see a lot of questions about the kind of nonpartisan, you know, very technocratic governing style that Charlie Baker has employed.
Yeah, and kind of to that point as well, Steve, what it reminds me of is obviously he completely swamped his last reelection campaign. But one of the actual attacks against him that got a bit more traction, though obviously not very much, was the idea that if you like him locally, that's great. But also because of his party affiliation, Charlie Baker is still raising money that then benefits kind of the broader national Republican efforts. So that was one thing that, like, the Massachusetts Dems did try and kind of like push against there, saying, you know, you may feel kind of neutral or apolitical about Charlie Baker on the state level, but don't forget that obviously states interact with their federal parties too. And so that's kind of something to keep in mind.
Yeah, he looked he looked so super uncomfortable when he was asked by Jay Gonzalez.
Yeah, know, that's right.
Are you voting for Jeff Neal? Are you voting for the whole ticket, all the candidates up and down the ballot?
Yeah, that was a rough one.
Really, really sort of squirmed in his chair and then eventually said that he was.
But well,
on the flip side, one of the reasons that people might or lawmakers, state lawmakers said to me why they might not want to vote for something like this is because Charlie Baker is so popular among people in Massachusetts. I mean, what does he have, like an 84% approval rating for how he's handled coronavirus and things like that? So, you know, in a state where people really like Charlie Baker and approve of him, if the state legislature votes to take his power away in some way during an election year, I think that's going to be a tough thing for them to do.
That's a really good question. I mean, I don't know. It's so hard to start because everybody's kind of got different interests and so much depends on like where the Senate is at that point.
Speaking of
the Senate and speaking of rifts within the Mass GOP, there were two state There were two state Senate special elections here in Massachusetts last night, and both ended with Democrats taking the seats that had been held by Republicans. Democrats now officially control 36 of the Senate's 40 seats, up from 34 before last night's voting. There's a lot going on here, some of which we've kind of already been touching on as far as splits within the Mass GOP. But before we kind of dive in, Stephanie, let's start with the basics. Walk us through what happened. What were the results?
Okay, so there were two state special Senate elections, which is just an amazing alliteration phrase, last night. So they were scheduled for March, but they were postponed because of the coronavirus. And so two pretty established members of the state Senate who were Republicans had moved on to take different jobs. Former Senator Don Humison is now the mayor of Westfield, and then Plymouth Senator Vinnie DiMacedo went and took a job at Bridgewater State University. So two Democrats ended up winning last night, which took away two seats from the state Senate that were held by Republicans, which you usually wouldn't think is that big of a deal. But now there are only four Republican state senators left. It is the final four in a body of 40 members.
And it might not stop there either, right? There's still a couple that are kind of at risk in November.
That's right. So there are a couple of state senators who are at risk. One is Senator Dean Tran, who just was stripped of his leadership post for a pretty scathing ethics investigation. And then Republican Senator Pat O'Connor has a Democratic challenger for the second cycle in a row. And something to watch here is he won. So he beat his last Democratic challenger by around 6 percentage points. But Charlie Baker was on the ballot that year in 2018. A Republican who people in Massachusetts really like to vote for. But on the other hand, President Trump is going to be on the ballot in November this year, a Republican that people in Massachusetts largely do not like to vote for. So that might be kind of a tricky spot for him to be in.
Yeah, I mean, I am kind of interested as well by the sort of continued erosion since I think it was like the Tea Party was kind of the high watermark for Republicans who were holding seats in the Massachusetts legislature here. And so you've seen kind of a series of increasingly bad elections for the Mass GOP candidates here. Complicated, of course, by, as we've talked in the past, the fact that Charlie Baker doesn't really seem to be able to kind of pull other members of his party and with them. How much of that is because the party itself in Massachusetts doesn't really look a lot like Charlie Baker here?
I think that's a big part of it, particularly the voters. Our research department, otherwise known as our producer, Libby Gormley, did some research and found that the high watermark of Republicans in Massachusetts was 15. Mm-hmm. And that was the 1990 state Senate elections. So a little interesting historical footnote there. But I think that you just hit the nail on the head, which is that there is this big divide in terms of almost a historical divide between where the Republican Party in Massachusetts was and where it is now. You know, the party, the voters in the party, the leadership of the party are all very much Trump, on the Trump wing of the party, on the Trump train. Even in his tweet about and sort of statement about what happened after the what happened last night, Republican Party Chairman Jim Lyons, he said, "We want to thank our two state Senate candidates, Jay McMahon and John Cain, for stepping up to take on the radical Democrats." There's a thing right there, Trump language. "We lost both races. We're disappointed. The radical Democrats," there it is again, "are committed to fundamentally change our country." And then he says, "We're committed to keep America great," which is, of course, Trump's reelection slogan. So there's no inclination whatsoever to kind of back off and sort of rethink where the Mass GOP is positioned.
It's interesting. You know, they have had this kind of historical, or not historical, I don't know what the right word is, but kind of high profile split with Governor Baker ever since Jim Lyons was elected, former state senator who lost to a Democrat last cycle. He was elected as chairman of the Mass GOP. Since then, they've moved out of their office in Boston. They've had this kind of dramatic fight with Baker's campaign over fundraising data and email lists and things like that. They just really couldn't be further apart. It seems like their strategy is not working to lose two seats that have been held by Republicans for years, kind of considered the safest sort of Republican seat you can have in a state like Massachusetts. It's pretty blue. It's interesting to see how much support for Republicans has kind of dwindled.
Yeah. And also, I am interested to see kind of how the Mass GOP decides to target potential areas of inroads. I think it was the State House News Service that was noting that 12 incumbent Democrats said that they won't seek reelection, and including a few from districts that Jim Lyons thinks could be favorable to a Republican. So it might be the idea that they're kind of saying that we're not going to throw resources behind sort of shoot the moon cases, like obviously try and defend the seats that you have because you don't want to lose them, but also they're not going to spend their time trying to, you know, back a serious Republican challenger in, say, Cambridge.
Sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that was a that was kind of an optimistic spin that he was putting on it ways.
Yeah. I promise you it's an optimistic spin, but it is. It's interesting to me kind of like where where the spin is being pointed, like that it's not just saying we're being eroded, but also that there still needs to be kind of that sort of like thin thread saying like we aren't literally going to be voted down to zero. We think we could still gain a seat or two back.
Yeah, the thing that I tried to figure out whether this would be the fewest district that Republicans had ever been competitive in, and I couldn't quite nail down the stat on that. But basically, the way State House News reported it, he's expecting them to be competitive or to have candidates, not even be competitive, in 55 out of the 200 seats for the House and 8 out of the 40 seats for the Senate. So when you add those two together, it's 26.5% of seats will have a Republican challenger in it. The lowest number that has ever been competitive, in other words, have two major party candidates, is around 28 or 29%. Again, I couldn't quite nail down the stats on this, but it's something close to the least candidates that the Mass GOP has ever put forth. So I think part of that has to do with, again, just the movement that, you know, that their professed champion is someone with a 25% approval rating in Massachusetts. You know, when it comes to dealing with COVID-19, that's where Suffolk found Donald Trump. So I don't know, lots to keep track of there.
And I think maybe one more thing we could just note about this is that it wasn't just the Mass GOP backing these candidates last night. Charlie Baker did a robocall for John Cain, who ran for Don Humbison's seat in Westfield, the Republican. He endorsed him. There were photos on Facebook that the campaign was pushing out. So even, you know, like we were talking about earlier, Charlie Baker is still popular, but it doesn't seem like he has much pull when it comes to legislative races at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of that obviously is because I think maybe kind of as an outside observer here is what's most interesting to me is whether or not the approach should be or is, if we're going to be running Republicans in X number of races and we say we're competitive, is it competitive because they are running the kind of candidacy that like the Charlie Baker model of Republicans would suggest that the voters want to see? Or is it this full commitment to a more Trump style of mass GOP that they think could be potentially popular somewhere that it hasn't really been before? So I think, again, as we're looking for where that spin happens, for where that kind of push happens, it's always curious to me whether or not particular state parties feel the need to rebrand or double down.
Absolutely. But what we feel the need to do right now is to go on to our favorite segment and everybody's favorite segment of this podcast, partially because our producer is frantically waving via G-Chat, telling us that we're way over time. And of course, that's trivia. We've got to do trivia. So now we're going to play our trivia jingle.
Awkward pause.
Awkward pause. Nobody sent us a trivia jingle.
Please, folks, we need a trivia jingle. Somebody send us one. We're begging you. Sing it into a voice memo and text it to me or something.
But the trivia question for this week has to do with horses and Massachusetts, our two favorite topics.
Yay!
And the question is, Hall of Fame jockey Chris McCarron is famous for big time wins, including multiple Kentucky Derby, Preakness, and Belmont Stakes victories. He was also born and raised in Massachusetts. Question is, what city did he grow up in?
All right, Jessica Paquette, we're looking at you.
We are. You're like our, you or Mara Dolan would be the only people that listen to this podcast who might know the answer to this one.
So we are going to let you think on that. But in the meantime, that is all the time that we have today. Thank you so much for watching. My name is Stephanie Murray.
I'm Jennifer Smith.
And I'm Steve Cazella. Our producer, as always, is Libby Gormley. Don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And please do leave us ratings and reviews because it helps others find us and also pads our already sort of oversized egos. Also, make sure to sign up for the Politico Massachusetts Playbook if you're not already subscribed. And do call us at the Massing Polling Group if we can be of assistance to you with polling or survey work. And for now, thank you all so much for listening/watching, and we will see you next week.
Cheers.